The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road, but if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge and enjoy 10 smoke-free, spit-free days for just $5.95. Order online and start your new journey today. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday Savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
There's a thing as a comedian I realize where you kind of have to just like say stuff randomly when you're in comedy. You know what I mean? You have to like let your mouth lead. If it occurs to you to say something, you just kind of have to start saying it and then hope that by the time the sentence is over, you've come up with a punchline. You sort of like just need to embrace that. And that means that sometimes you end up annoying people if the thing you said wasn't actually funny. Then you just said something weird and everyone's like, why did you say that? Right? Hello, my name is Adam Conover. I'm a comedian, and I'm the host of the new show, The G Word, out now on Netflix.
Hello, hello, gentle listeners, and welcome back to another episode of Off the Beat with me here now, your host, Brian Baumgartner. My guest today is a genius, or at least a true comedy genius, Mr. Adam Conover. Now, you may know him from shows like Adam Ruins Everything or The G Word on Netflix, where he has continued to bring his unique brand of comedy, which is basically ruining everything we love, to the masses. Unlike many in the business, Adam, he doesn't shy away from the hard topics, because at the end of the day, he not only wants to make us laugh, he wants to make us think. And I can safely say that his jokes would have probably gone over Kevin Malone's head. But I, Brian Baumgartner, I'm a big fan, and I can't wait for you to get to know him like I do. This was such a fun chat. Let's get it going, Mr. Adam Conover.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
What's up, Adam?
Hi, Brian. How's it going?
It's going all right. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's wonderful to be here.
Thank you so much for joining me. Now, I don't know if you're aware of this or not. I was given an opportunity to work with you on your show, Adam Ruins Everything.
No, wait. Tell me more, and let's see if it jogs something loose.
Well, I will tell you, I did not know your show. Of course, I'd heard of it. I had not watched it. And I was asked to do your show, it was about the TSA. That's what I remember. And it made me deep dive into watching your show because I was like, well, I got to find out what this is about. Ultimately, we could not work it out. I don't know. I was in out of the country or something. But anyway, I have been a fan of yours ever since then. I don't know who you eventually got to cast, but I'm sure they were
better than I was. I don't remember either. My memory of that. So we on Adam Ruins Everything, we used to go out to special guest stars all the time and try to get, you know, recognizable, incredible comedic actors such as yourself. And let me tell you something, it rarely worked, especially because that first that TSA episode was in our first year. So we hadn't aired on True TV yet. We had only been on YouTube.
Right.
And so I wouldn't blame anybody in Hollywood to say, what is this True TV show I got to show up at 6 a.m. for, and they don't have any trailers? We didn't have talent trailers our first year. We were really shoestring. So, you know, maybe better for you that you didn't make it and no harm.
All right. Well, I was aware because I had done some work in the past with College Humor.
Yeah.
Which is obviously where the show started. But before we get into all of that, Adam is here with us. And I wanted to go back to your childhood a little bit maybe investigate how you came to be you and thereby your character, which I really want to talk to you about. I've heard some interviews with you describing Adam. So I want to talk about that a little bit, but you were grew up in Smithtown, New York. Is that right?
I think that's actually my place of birth. I grew up in a town called, in two towns, Port Jeff Station and then Wading River on Long Island. Smithtown's not far away. I think that's just where the hospital is.
All right. Well, that makes sense. A family full of PhDs. It's been said you're the only one in your family without a PhD. Is that right?
That is true. My dad, this is, I'm not going to recite a stand-up joke. My dad's a marine biologist. My mom is a botanist. My sister is a nuclear physicist. I'm here talking to you right now.
Do you think that intellectual curiosity, though, that existed clearly in your, do you think that influenced your comedic style?
Oh, absolutely it did.
Okay.
Absolutely it did. I mean, in a number of different ways. Number one is that growing up, we watched a lot of educational television. We watched a ton of PBS and, there was kind of a golden age of science on television in the late 80s, early 90s too. And you had shows like Bill Nye's show. There's a show called Beekman's World. There was a whole bunch of great stuff on PBS, like 3-2-1 Contact and Square TV. And so I loved all those shows. And I didn't actually realize until 2 or 3 years into making Adam Ruins Everything that I had kind of reproduced that same format or updated it of, you know, this very animated host telling you things with, you know, lots of comedy and lots of sound effects and visual effects. And I realized, oh, that's why kids gravitated towards my show. Like, I never thought that we'd have a fan base of kids. The show was on at 10:30 at night on Tuesdays. But very quickly, kids started really watching and falling in love with the show. And I realized that had something to do with it. But then, yeah, apart from that, I was just always trying to live up to the family business, you know, learning more about the world and communicating it to people. My sister actually went into science communication. She's now a science reporter, a physics reporter for Science News Magazine. So we're kind of in closer lines of work than I would have expected, where we're both communicating with the public about research and facts and interesting things.
Right. When did you realize that you had an interest in performing? Was that early on for you?
Oh, man. Yeah, it was. I remember there being some, not even school play, just some kind of class presentation for some class in like sixth grade. And I made up like a funny little character of like a real estate agent with like a funny miscellaneous European accent for it. I don't remember why or what the context was, but, and I did I had like a catchphrase, and the catchphrase was, "Hiya, hiya, hiya! You want to buy a house?" I don't remember what that was supposed to mean, like what the context of this was. I have no idea what the context of it was, but I remember kids coming up to me on like the playground afterwards, asking me to do the line that they had seen me do in class. They wanted me to do it again. This is my first time ever telling this story. This is a very deep memory of mine, and I remember really liking that.
that
they wanted me to do the line, and so yeah, I did. You know, I did theater in high school, stuff like that. Actually, let me back up a second, because I was also diagnosed with ADD as a kid, and I was a very impulsive, shouting out kind of kid. I was always, you know, like you know, messing up in social situations and like being disruptive in class. And so I was yelled at a lot as a kid and told to shut up and be quiet. And a lot of that went into me too. So I did do theater in high school, but then by the time I got to college, it had kind of been beaten out of me. And I was like, I don't know if I like performing. Like, I'm not sure it's for me. And then my friends created a sketch comedy group and I knew I wanted to join the group. I joined and I started writing sketches. But for the first year, I didn't perform because I was like, no, that's not what I do. Oh, I'll just be behind the scenes and I'll write stuff, until I finally figured out that like I really loved performing, you know?
Yeah. So I'm assuming you're referring to Old English. This is the name of the yes. sketch comedy group.
Correct.
I mean, you it doesn't get more intellectual sounding than that. I guess.
Well, except we were named after the malt liquor, Brian.
Oh, really? Is that true?
That is true. That is, I mean, that is what we like to drink at Bard College was 40 ounce bottles. It's an expensive school, so you got to save your money where you can.
My image was totally different. Like, oh, the nerds at Bard College coming up with old English.
You're right. It sounds like Ren Faire. Yeah.
It does. No, it's exactly what I thought. So you started just writing.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the other people in the group were also doing improv. Like, the thing had happened where one of the members of the group, you know, in between semesters during the summer, had spent a summer in New York City and took, like, two UCB classes and then came back and taught the rest of the group. No, we're not doing Whose Line Is It Anyway style improv anymore. We're doing The Herald. We're doing long-form improv. And then proceeded to, like, you know, do the worst long-form improv you've ever seen, which is a story of so many college sketch groups, some improv groups, I'm sure. But I didn't join the improv side of it because I was like, no, I don't want to sort of be out there and you know, et cetera. I had like a fear of working that way, I guess. Yeah. You, there's a thing as a comedian I realize where you kind of have to just like say stuff randomly when you're in comedy. You know what I mean? You have to like let your mouth lead. If it occurs to you to say something, you just kind of have to start saying it. And then hope that by the time the sentence is over, you've come up with a punchline. You sort of like just need to embrace that. And that means that sometimes you end up annoying people if the thing you said wasn't actually funny. Then you just said something weird and everyone's like, why did you say that? Right. So as a kid, I was saying stuff like that all the time. You know, I was just constantly whatever thought came into my head. And that was specifically what I was like yelled at and chastised over was like, why did you think before you speak? Why are you so impulsive?
Right.
Yeah. And so for that reason, I never felt comfortable doing improv. And even when it came to like sketch performing, I was like nervous about it. And it took me years to sort of break myself of that until, you know, I became a comfortable performer again. And then when I did, I finally felt it solved a lot of issues for me, like really diving into stand-up comedy and live performance, like cured me of a lot of social awkwardness and things like that. I'm jumping ahead a little bit, though. I don't know if you're trying to go chronologically.
Interesting. No, I think that's fascinating. So in what way did that help you?
Well, so throughout my college years and high school years as well, but also my early 20s, I kind of felt very socially awkward. I felt like I'm different from other people. When I talk to them, they're like, who is this weirdo? I'm not good at parties. You know, everyone can tell there's something sort of wrong with me and I should really spend my time alone inside playing video games. Or I remember specifically, I liked the very early years of online dating because I was like, I'm better online than in person. I like to send chats, you know. Like I had that kind of stuff. I can control that situation. At a bar, I'm a little bit confused, you know.
Right.
And I had basically what I'd call now social anxiety. So let's fast forward a little bit. I had a college sketch group. We all moved to New York City. We did sketch comedy there with some success. We were making videos for some websites and things like that. For a couple of years, we did live shows at UCB and elsewhere. Then the group broke up and I was like, okay, I want to keep doing comedy. I need to, you know, I want to keep having this feeling of getting laughs and it's the best feeling in the world. And how do I do that? So I started doing improv and stand up simultaneously at UCB and also just doing open mics around New York. And I did open mics for, oh, you know, 8 years or something like that. You have to do open mics for a long time. And by the end of me doing that, by the time I was a stand-up comic, it cured me of my social anxiety because stand-up is like intensely social. Like you go to the open mic, you go to the show and you see all the other comics. Hey, how you doing? Hey, good to see you. Blah, 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 blah. You know, you're just sort of being chippy with them, tossing you know, whatever, just tossing lines back and forth and just sort of being in this kind of social soup. You know, you're just, you go and you give everybody like a quick backslap hug and, you know, then you go up there and you're just in it. And but after I'd done it for like 5 or 6 years, I started to realize, wait, I don't feel awkward in social situations anymore. Now I feel like the most comfortable person here. I'm the person at the party who makes other people feel at ease because I'm so, you know, just like, hey, how's it go? What's up, everybody? You know,
right.
Just sort of like fluidly moving in the situation. It's one of the reasons why I try to encourage people to do stand up. You know, people have a fear of stand up. Improv, now there's a culture of people taking a level zero improv class, even if they have no intention of performing, just sort of like for fun, you know, to get out of their shell or whatever. No one does that for stand-up. And I kind of wish there was, because it's so many people's greatest fear is to go stand up in front of other people and be exposed to them. When it's just you and a microphone and those eyes are looking at you, you're totally exposed. You know, they can see the truth about you no matter what you do. They can see if you're nervous. They can tell if you're overconfident. They can, you know, if you say something that isn't funny, then everybody knows it wasn't funny. That kind of exposure is very frightening to people. So a lot of people, oh, I could never, ever do stand-up. I could never do it. And I always encourage those people, just give it a try. Go to a couple open mics. Like, yeah, it's going to suck. You're going to bomb sometimes. You're going to realize it doesn't kill you. And you're also going to have the experience of getting a laugh, because everybody can get a laugh at some point in their first couple times.
Right.
And you'll know what that's like. And if you do it over and over again, then you're doing stand-up. You might not be good at it yet, but you're a comic if you want to try it. I do try to encourage people to do that.
Right. Did you consider yourself more at this point a stand-up comedian or an improv guy? I don't even know what that means.
Well, at that time, I was doing stand-up and improv simultaneously. And after about 3 years of doing both, I realized, oh, I'm a stand-up guy. Like, because okay. I took all the improv classes. I got to the advanced levels. I was in an independent group. We had practice sessions. You know, I was doing improv. And I realized, you know what? I still don't want to step off the back line. Like when a scene's happening, I still feel like I hope I don't need to tag in because I'm not comfortable with it. And what I realized it is I really like being funny and thinking on my feet, but as myself. I enjoy just being there with the audience. Hey, all of us are in this same room together. What's happening over there? You know, oh my God, someone dropped a plate. Let's talk about it. That sort of thing, as opposed to having to think on my feet as another person, as a character, was not my way of being funny. And so I respectfully, with great respect for improv, stopped doing it and did not regret it.
Okay. Well, it's fascinating. It was almost as though you knew what direction my question was going. So yeah, so in improv, right? You're essentially, it is a series of characters that you're creating. With stand-up, and that was what I was going to ask you, like, it is you, and but to what degree is that a character as well?
Mm.
Or do you consider it that it's you?
That is such a good question. I would say other comics might disagree. I would say it's not a character. But it is a constant struggle to create a stage persona that feels as much like yourself as possible. So you do create to a certain extent a stage persona, but to me, it doesn't feel like putting on a costume or a change of clothes. It feels like just accentuating a part of yourself or finding a part of yourself, accessing a part of yourself and bringing that onto stage. And the hard part is accessing it in a way that feels natural. So what I always tell people about stand-up is that everyone, almost everyone, I would say everyone, has had the experience of being funny to their friends, right? Telling a funny story at a party.
Most
people, almost everybody. Probably a couple people are such dead fish, they've never told a funny story.
Right.
But everyone's had the experience of laughing with friends, right? The trick is of stand-up, figuring out how to be that version of yourself. You're not always that version of yourself, right? Sometimes you're at home and you're sleeping, you're just watching TV and you don't want to tell a funny story right now. But sometimes, at other times, you're your party self where you're up and you're energized. And so how do you access that part of yourself on demand whenever you want, whenever you need to go on stage, no matter how you feel, you got to access that part of yourself.
Right.
So the trick of stand-up is having a conversation with the audience that feels natural, even though it's a one-sided conversation. It's a conversation where one party never speaks, the audience, right? All they do is laugh. It's against the rules for them to talk. They get yelled at if they talk. You know, in my case, I'm on tour right now. I'm going to be in Boston this weekend, and I'm going to be on stage talking for an hour straight. And I need to make that feel like a natural conversation rather right. than a speech or a lecture or something like that. And so that's the challenge, is accessing who you naturally are. And what I really okay. want to do is I want to give people access to that real self that I have. That's how I think about it.
Yeah. Interesting. I do find that that fascinating, that idea. And I think that you're right in general, you know, unless you're, you know, a comic who is very specifically playing a character. Larry the Cable Guy, for example, is not his sure. name. That's not his name.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But for you, finding a perspective, which I think ultimately makes then your comedy more personal, or at least appear more personal to you and who you are. Mm-hmm.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
If you're a smoker or dipper looking to make a change, you really only need one reason to do it. But with Zyn nicotine pouches, you can find many. Not only did Zyn create the first ever nicotine pouch, we're still America's number one choice for smoke-free, spit-free nicotine satisfaction. It could be because Zyn is made with only 6 simple ingredients, including naturally derived nicotine salt. Or maybe it's because Zyn is the only nicotine pouch with a 10-day trial. For anyone worried Zyn won't cut it like traditional tobacco, just ask one of the millions of people who have achieved lasting change. You have lots of options when it comes to nicotine satisfaction, but there's only one Zyn. Find your Zyn online or in a store near you at Zyn.com/find. That's Zyn.com/find.
Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
So you start working for College Humor as at least a staff member in 2012. Now, is that your first experience posting things, or had you begun posting things on the site before you went to work with them?
That was my first experience posting anything on College Humor. I had posted things to other websites in the past, but never to okay. College Humor until I started working there. And by that time, I'd been doing stand-up for a couple of years when I was working there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to join them? Was there something specific about them and what they were doing that interested you? Or
yeah, I mean, it was, first of all, it was one of the only comedy jobs in New York City that I felt that I could get. You know, there were also, you know, there's late night and SNL and stuff like that, but those are the most rarefied jobs in the world. You know, it isn't like, you know, in LA, there are sort of these low level comedy jobs. You know, you could write for, you know, an award show or something like that. In New York, it's like those big shows are nothing. And so College Humor was like one of the only places that was actually employing comedy writers. And I had actually just worked my first Writers Guild job. I had written for a VH1 sketch show that aired in like 2011 that I honestly did not have a great experience at. And I was like, I don't want to move to LA yet. And I was like, no, I want to stay in New York. And I happened to email a friend of mine who worked at College Humor and was like, are you guys looking for writers? And that's a question that almost never gets a yes. Like you don't even really send emails like that. You know,
right.
People will sometimes send me an email. Are you looking for writers? And I'm like, no, I hire writers for like 2 weeks once every 3 years. You know, like I'm never looking.
Right.
These slots never come up. But I had emailed him and he had right at that moment decided, I'm going to quit my job. And he recommended me to his boss, later my boss, Sam Reich, and said, you know, hey, this guy's good. We should hire him because he had been a fan of mine, which is like one of the biggest favors anyone's ever done me. It really was a kickstart to my career. But yeah, I mean, College Humor was really a comedy writer's paradise in those days because, you know, you got a middle class New York City income. I had health insurance. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was an office job, which was good to be able to have the health insurance and the stability. But then my entire job was to write 2 comedy sketches a week. And they could kind of be whatever I wanted them to be. Like it really was funny first. What makes us laugh in the room? Let's make that. And they made them. And also as a writer, you got to sort of produce the episode, like, or produce the sketch. You didn't like have to do any of the production work, but you talked with the director. You could go be on set. You could supervise the edit and give notes on it. And so, you know, it was a huge benefit to my writing to have to actually be outputting, you know, 2 sketches a week, and then one of them would get made and then I would get to post it on YouTube and see how it did. And that eventually, you know, is what led to Adam Ruins Everything. Adam Ruins Everything was originally a comedy sketch that I had written at College Humor.
Yeah. By the way, I worked with Sam Reich on a project that I did at College Humor as well. I always had a great experience with those guys. And my experience was that,
Yeah,
like you said, there was a total creative freedom to explore just what you, as long as it made other people laugh there, you were given the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, it was incredible. It was a strange moment in time because the reason we had that freedom was because, you know, College Humor was owned by Barry Diller's IAC, giant media company. And he had decided, hey, for the next couple of years, I'm going to bankroll this and see what we can turn it into. And, you know, so we got to basically operate at a loss for years. And then finally, you know, Facebook ate the entire, you know, online media business and killed it purposefully. They did it. I've talked about that publicly before. And, you know, Diller said, okay, well, that's enough of that, and pulled the plug. And, you know, now they're soldiering on as a subscription service called Dropout, which is doing really well. But that's sort of like golden era of online comedy. Just, it was a blip, you know, and it'll unfortunately seemingly never happen again.
Yeah, but there were some amazing things that came out of it. One that I must mention, the Mitt Romney style, based on the Gangnam style.
Thank you for mentioning that.
It currently has over 65 million views still. Were there any other specific sketches that bring you fond memories of your time there at College Humor?
I mean, let me just talk about Mitt Romney style for a second, because that was such a massive hit. And I wrote that with my colleague, Emily Axford. We wrote it together. But I did the voice of Mitt Romney in the Mitt Romney rap. And that was 10 years ago now, which is really bizarre to think about. But if you think, you know, that's when Gangnam Style was huge 10 years ago. It's a decade old. It also, of course, dates to the 2012 presidential election. But it was literally just, I was obsessed with Gangnam Style. I loved Gangnam Style. And I think my girlfriend Lisa said, she was like, what about Mitt Romney style? And I was like, oh, that's perfect. And we wrote it all up. It fit perfectly. The Gangnam Style is a song. And you can tell, even if you don't speak Korean, it's a song about wealth and about, you know, like celebrating this ostentatious kind of dorky wealth.
Right.
So it worked perfectly for Mitt Romney. But it was an absolute like sensation. And we worked in, you know, the 46% line, that, you know, his famous gaffe. And it was produced. The whole thing was shot by Vincent Payone, who's a wonderful director. And it was like, really, he produced the hell out of it. It's beautiful. It like mimics shot for shot Gangnam Style. It cost tens of thousands of dollars to make. Not in a million years could you get that kind of money for a YouTube video anymore. Never in a million years. And so it's something that I'm still like weirdly proud of, despite it being the most dated piece of content. I still go watch it. And I'm like, we fucking nailed it with this.
That's awesome. Thank you. There as well, you created as a pitch in the room, Adam Ruins Everything, where you debunk common misconceptions and reveal sometimes awful truths about the things that people love. How did you first come up with this idea?
I had been doing in my stand-up this routine about De Beers and the diamond engagement ring. Just years before this, I had read an article about how the diamond engagement ring was a marketing creation by the De Beers Corporation, and that it, you know, just eventually became part of our culture, even though it was just something that they shoved into ads to make you think you had to buy a diamond engagement ring. And it had blown my mind when I learned it, and I had always just remembered it. And I eventually wrote a stand-up joke about it where I explained that to people, and I noticed they started reacting more than they did just to my jokes. You know, when you're in the trenches doing stand-up every night in bar basements and, you know, back rooms, after a while, you get pretty good at making people laugh. And the challenge becomes, well, what do I do after that? After I make them laugh? What do I do that makes them remember me? That makes them want to come to my next show? And I realized, when I tell them this information, they sort of lean forwards. They get a little bit curious. They want to hear more. So I started working more and more material like that into my act. And then I had to write 2 sketches a week of College Humor. And I said, well, all right, let me write this up as a sketch. But what I did was I had previously written monologue style sketches before where I was explaining something to the audience, but they never got greenlit. And I remember the other writers being kind of like, this is kind of didactic. You know, you're kind of ranting on and on about this. You know, it's not that likable. And so what I did was Emily and Murph, 2 of my coworkers, fellow writers at College Humor, I just wrote them into the script, making fun of me for saying this stuff. You know, like, oh my God, why are you telling us this? This is so annoying. I'm proposing to my girlfriend here, man. Why you got to bust in and tell me all this shit about the diamond engagement ring? And that ended up being the comedic engine of the entire series was, you know, people chastising me for saying the thing, which by the way, fits very well with what I told you earlier. You know, as a kid, I was constantly chastised for blurting things out, for saying more than I should have. And so really what I was doing in Adam Ruins Everything was turning my childhood pain and this thing that I was here as a kid into comedy. I was accessing that previous version of myself, that child, you know, Adam Ruins Everything, that character version of myself is often, I think, of based on myself as a kid. Not able to understand social cues, not able to understand when people want you to leave. Like, it's a little bit high voiced, you know, it's a little bit the Pee Wee Herman version of me, you know?
Okay.
So that's sort of where all those themes come together.
Right. But unlike your stand-up, is that a character? Do you consider that more of a character?
I do. Yes, no, Adam Ruins Everything. That is a character. It has my name, but, you know, we developed that special hairstyle for that character. I have, it was my real hair, right? But we made it taller. We made it this big sort of three-dimensional coif. And, you know, this specific way of dressing where I dress very self-consciously nerdy, you know, sort of way too much version of menswear. And so, you know, there's elements that match my real life and elements that don't. But yeah, that was a character version of me.
Right. It occurs to me, you talked about it returning back to some of the stuff that you watched as a kid, Bill Nye the Science Guy, that sort of high energy, it relating to kids. But it's also, when you think about today's, you know, media style, fast, funny, accessible, and able to tell a full story in, well, a relatively small amount of time. A happy accident that it sort of begins to fit into what's popular in media today, or was that intentionally drawn that way?
I mean, I hope that we helped make media that way. I hope that we helped bend that curve. I mean, I really wanted to create something that was very information dense. Because I hated nonfiction television or documentary television where they take so long to tell you anything, where it's just drawn out. I want, give me the information quickly. So we would pack, you know, these entire stories into 7 minutes that would hopefully, you know, we would try to have 3 stories that blow your mind plus a conclusion every single episode. And every episode was, you know, 23 minutes long or whatever. I forget the exact runtime. 21:30 maybe. And so that, you know, the show had to move quickly. And then we wanted to pack in jokes and pack in visuals. And, you know, we wanted to throw the kitchen sink in there. I mean, when we created the show, I was like, this is my one shot. You know, I'm lucky to get a pilot. I'm a sketch writer at a website. This is my shot to like make a series. And all I want is one season. That's all that matters. And so I was like, I got to pack everything in there that I can. You know, there's no holding back. Every moment needs to be funny. Every moment needs to be visual. Nothing is just static straight to camera. It's all motion all the time. And, you know, I think a lot of that came from anxiety and maybe it was a little bit too much. But I also think it's what drew people to the show and it's what made it memorable for people. It's what made it also work on TV and on YouTube. You know, one segment from every episode was posted on YouTube, made a big difference. A lot of people still think that I was just a YouTuber. They didn't realize that it was a television show as well.
Right.
That they've only seen a third of it, that there's like more segments on HBO Max that they could go watch right now.
Right. What thing did you debunk that you're the most proud of?
Oh, that I'm the most proud of. That's a really good question. Though I think the ones that I'm most proud of are the segments about the criminal justice system, of which we did many. We did an episode called Adam Ruins Forensic Science about how polygraph tests don't work and fingerprints don't work and eyewitness testimony is like deeply flawed. We did Adam Ruins Justice, which is about, you know, how people can't get a fair trial and about how public defenders are disadvantaged over, you know, district attorneys. And this leads to people being sent to jail when they shouldn't be. And then we did Adam Ruins Prison, which is all about, you know, the prison industrial complex and mass incarceration. And, you know, I mean, these issues to me, mass incarceration is like next to climate change. It's our greatest national sin. Like, this is what we're going to be looking back on 100 years from now going, can you believe that we did this to each other, that we, you know, imprisoned more people than anyone else on earth, that, you know, the majority of people alive on earth today who are in prisons are in American prisons. And we're the wealthiest country in the world. We're just locking each other up for having, you know, an eighth of weed in our pockets. It's unconscionable. And so the fact that we did multiple episodes about that, and I got to meet folks like Daryl Atkinson, who is formerly incarcerated man himself, became a civil rights attorney, got his law degree, and now works to get other people who are wrongfully imprisoned out of prison. And he's working to reform the criminal justice system. Like, oh, that is the most important thing to me. And yeah, I'm really, really proud of that work.
Yeah. I remember I became aware of those episodes right around the time that the, you know, the sort of documentary focusing on a crime thing started happening, Making of a Murderer and Well, There's Staircase. And the idea that we think about eyewitness testimony especially, or even some forensic evidence you think is, you know, infallible. And, yeah, you know, I think you know, I don't know if taught me something, but really begin to give a different perspective to people, which I think is really cool and ultimately important.
Thank you. I mean, yeah, I'm really proud to be able to do that. And it's true that, you know, the true crime field overall is just rife with misinformation about the criminal justice system. You know, that it's the structure of it is sort of, you want to say, okay, the perp was caught in an interesting way. And so forensic science often comes into it. And unfortunately, like forensic science, the vast majority of it is not scientific.
Yeah.
Period. And unfortunately, the main function of our criminal justice system is to lock up people who shouldn't be locked up. Sorry to tell you that.
You know, right.
The individual stories of the, you know, diabolical, you know, rare serial killer murders that are solved by some detective, it's not like they don't happen, but they're like the outlier of all outliers in terms of what the criminal justice system is. The criminal justice system is about, you know, roughing up and incarcerating people of color. Like, that's what it's for. That's what it does. That's what it does, like, on a massive level. And you know, a lot of these techniques that the cops come up with, things like from the manual that they use to interrogate prisoners, you know, has been called a manual for false confessions, you know, for producing false confessions, because it's this way of like browbeating people until they say whatever you want them to say. You know, it's just like these are techniques that cops use to, you know, be able to pin the blame on someone who they found in the vicinity, rather than a scientific method that they use to figure out who actually did it. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. that is like the practice of how our criminal justice system works. And just being able to like share that with people on cable television was really meaningful to me. And it's not like we were able to change those practices just by exposing them, but being able to spread the word was really mattered to me. And it's still work that I continue to do.
What episode had the most surprising backlash from viewers?
Oh, the most surprising backlash. Good question. I mean, I would always hear from people who were personally involved in the industries we would cover. Like we did an episode about death, and we did an episode about the funeral home industry and what a racket it is. And, you know, people who work in funeral homes were like, hey, we're nice. We try our best. You don't tell us we're bad. And I'm like, no, I'm not saying you individually are bad, but you like work in an industry that's like full of scams and, you know, is like sort of designed to scam people. Sorry. It's like, you know, we compared them to car salesmen, right? Everyone knows car salesmen are scammy. Funeral home people are just as scammy. Doesn't mean that every single car salesman's a piece of shit, but it does mean like, you know, don't trust the car salesman. Right. So we would get a lot like that. You know, sometimes we get weird backlash. We did an episode about Luxottica, the glasses monopoly, and how they jack up the prices of eyewear for everybody. And Luxottica didn't hassle us, but the Huffington Post wrote an article about our episode, and Luxottica sent like a cease and desist to the Huffington Post, which makes no sense. They didn't change anything because the Huffington Post was like, well, this is all true. And it's like covered in, it is like journalism. Like everything I do, like I'm getting it from journalism, right? I'm just repeating what's in newspapers, what's in scientific studies. You know, I don't do anything that isn't fully backed by the research. So I always have really strong grounds to stand on. So there isn't much that they can say. They just got like kind of cranky at the Huffington Post, I guess. The one that got the most surprising backlash was we did a segment on alpha males about how the idea that you see on the internet, there's alpha males and there's beta males, and you got to be an alpha. You don't want to be a beta. This is beta behavior, like that kind of thing. It's all bullshit. It's not scientific at all. There's not two types of men out there. It's not part of science, right? Do I even need to say this? It's like astrology, you know? Right. It's just like a literary way of understanding people that's not based in anything. It's also not based, you know, in wolf packs, which is what it comes from. The guy who coined the idea of there being alphas and betas in wolf packs eventually retracted it because he realized he was just looking at parents, that like the wolves don't like choose an alpha or whatever. It's not based on behavior. It's just the dad of the wolf pack is like bosses everybody around, you know? So, and so does the mom. So anyway, we did a pretty straightforward segment on this, and I just was swarmed by so many dudes online being like, beta, you're a beta. And I'm like, no, that's not an insult to me because that doesn't exist. Like, it's not real. It's like someone said, like, it's like, I'm like, yeah, unicorns didn't exist. And then they're like, you're a unicorn. I'm like, no, I'm not. I said they don't exist. What the fuck are you talking about? Idiot. That got a fair amount of meathead backlash, but you know, it's still fun to tell the story. You know, it was like kicking a hornet's nest. Sometimes, you know, you're doing it, you know?
Right. All right, here's one more. What was the biggest thing that was ruined for you by your staff or a researcher or a writer on the show? Where you were like, come on.
I mean, the one I always say is we did a segment on the Olympics. And, you know, I love the Olympics. It's my favorite sporting event. But the Olympics itself is like the worst organization. It's one of the most corrupt organizations. It's bad for everybody. It's bad for the athletes who are not paid. We talked to an athlete who was literally living out of his car the same year that he won a gold medal for the United States, you know, because they're not paid, nor can they use the fact that they're in the Olympics to like earn money from endorsements or things like that, unless it's like approved by the Olympics. Michael Phelps is able to make money from being on the cover of the Wheaties box, but nobody else is. You know, the fencers aren't making any money. They're paying their own way to go and be on NBC at 2 a.m. And the cities where the Olympics are hosted are devastated by the Olympics because they build all this infrastructure that's specific to the Olympics and is never used again. Which is why there's like a big movement of people, you know, who are against the Olympics coming to Los Angeles, for instance, because it's just like, you know, a huge money suck and it benefits nobody but, you know, the developers and, you know, the crowds who come there for one weekend. Now, I'm still going to go to the Olympics when it's in Los Angeles. you bet your ass I am, because I, you know, I love the sports, but the structure that creates them is terrible. And it's based on a lie, you know?
Right.
There's There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid Kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
If you're a smoker or dipper looking to make a change, you really only need one reason to do it. But with Zyn nicotine pouches, you can find many. Not only did Zyn create the first ever nicotine pouch, we're still America's number one choice for smoke-free, spit-free nicotine satisfaction. It could be because Zyn is made with only 6 simple ingredients, including naturally derived nicotine salt. Or maybe it's because Zyn is the only nicotine pouch with a 10-day trial. For anyone worried Zyn won't cut it like traditional tobacco, just ask one of the millions of people who have achieved lasting change. You have lots of options when it comes to nicotine satisfaction, but there's only one Zyn. Find your Zyn online or in a store near you at Zyn.com/find. That's Zyn.com/find. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
You have a new show now.
Yes.
The G word about the government. Mm-hmm. I hear it's loosely based on Michael Lewis' book, The Fifth Risk, Undoing Democracy.
Correct.
How did you get involved with the series, or what was your pitch to do it?
Well, so here's what happened. I had read the book, The Fifth Risk, by Michael Lewis. Michael Lewis is one of our very best journalists, one of the best, you know, narrative writers that we have, narrative nonfiction writers. I had read the book. I loved the book. And I had said, you know, oh my gosh, I would love to do some of these stories on television if I have a chance. Adam Ruins Everything at this point had been canceled as a result of the AT&T Time Warner merger. We were one of the most popular shows on True TV, but you know, this merger went through and they literally fired everybody from True TV, just like happens after every kind of corporate merger, right? There's huge layoffs. They, in this case, axed the entire network and then put it all under TBS and TNT, had those executives run it. And those executives started canceling all the shows until they finally canceled mine. But I was like, all right, I'm looking for a new TV project. I read this book. I'm like, oh, this would be fun to do on TV sometime. About 6 months later, my manager calls me and says, hey, so I don't know if you'd be interested in this. Barack and Michelle Obama's company, Higher Ground, have optioned the rights to this book, The Fifth Risk. Do you want to go pitch on it? And I was like, the book that I just read and loved? Yes, I would like to go pitch on it. And my pitch was essentially, By the way, I did not pitch the Obamas. I pitched the people who work for the people who work for Obama. But I pitched them, you know, well, hey, I'll do it in my sort of very visual, you know, nonfiction investigative journalism style. And we'll, you know, we'll do somewhat like Adam Ruins Everything type segments that are scripted in a visual sketch comedy world. But then I'll also go to the places, meet the incredible government workers or people affected by things the government does not so well and meet them. And they liked it. They bit it. And we, you know, they had a big deal with Netflix. So we did it at Netflix and we spent the last 3 years working on that show. It's been about 3 years exactly since we first pitched it. But, and we were delayed because of COVID. That's part of why it took so long. It would have only taken 2 years, probably, if not for COVID. But yeah, it was pretty wild. But you know, for the show came out in May and is available on Netflix now. If people want to check it out, it's a documentary series about how the government works all in all its facets, both good and bad. It's me trying to figure out for myself what exactly is the United States government. What can we say about it? And Penn and Teller guest star. I fly through a hurricane with the Air Force's hurricane hunters. We visit a Cargill beef processing facility to see how the USDA does their work. It was a really remarkable experience, and I'm very proud of the show. I hope folks can check it out.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, it's fascinating to me. And again, you do use your unique brand of humor, but I think with the segments where you're actually going to the places and talking to real people, I think that it adds an additional level of humanity to you and to the work that I find really pleasurable as well. So congratulations on that.
Thank you for saying so.
And you got to work with Oscar Nunez, I saw. So yeah. Apparently, I know he is a big fan of yours, and that's really fun.
Oh, he had been also on Adam Ruins Everything in one of our first season episodes, an episode called Adam Ruins Work, and he was so fun to work with. He puts his all into everything. Again, this is we had not even been on the air yet. This is like 2015. He came and joined us on set and just put his all into this character on this dumb basic cable show. And so, of course, we wanted to bring him back for the new show where he plays a very harried FEMA agent who is really, really destroyed by bureaucracy. And he's just so funny and such a pleasure to work with and great guy. I was going to say just speaking about the character of the show, one of my big goals for this show was to drop the character for Adam Ruins Everything and instead just be myself on camera. In this show, it's just me. Hey, it's me, Adam Conover. I'm talking directly to you, the audience. Aren't you curious about this? I've always wondered that. Like, aren't you mad about this? I'm angry about that. So it was really interesting because I started to get the sense that I was like acting, but as myself, like I'm like trying to summon my own reactions. Okay, I need to be angry in this scene, but it's my own anger about how the federal government let down, you know, American citizens in Puerto Rico when it let so many of them die after Hurricane Maria. I have to summon that anger back again. So it's still there. It's funny because there's acting, but it's me as myself. You know, it was a really fascinating process to work that way.
So in a way, returning to your stand-up roots and trying to find a heightened version of yourself that you can summon anger or sadness or despair or comedy. Yeah, it's interesting. Interesting.
Exactly right.
All right. I want to play a game with you. Rapid fire game. I'm calling this Adam Ruins Things in a Rapid Fire Way. That's the name of this new game. All right. As quickly as humanly possible, I want you to tear the following things apart for people. Ready?
Okay, sure.
AI.
Oh, AI is fake, man. It's not real. It's not art. I mean, look, the algorithms do their thing, but they're not artificially intelligent. All right. Like we need to stop calling them artificially intelligent. It's like calling a regular car a flying car. You know, it goes from place to place, but it cannot fly. You know, artificial intelligence, these are just algorithms that, you know, suck in data on one end and spit out output on the other end. And we need to start looking at them that way. So like the chat bot cannot think, right? It's just outputting text and you are acting as though it can think. Your self-driving car cannot really drive itself. It has a very limited number of self-driving features. Don't take your hands off the fucking wheel. So the big problem with artificial intelligence is people believe in it too much. And as a result, they crash into barriers and die, and they start to fall in love with a dumbass algorithm that Google gave them. So that wasn't that rapid fire, but...
Comedians.
Comedians, my God. Well, could I just say that, like, we have an inflated opinion of ourselves. Like, we're just fucking comedians. Like, something I'm really sick of hearing is comedians go, like, I literally heard this as a quote from, I think, Chris Rock. He was like, we don't have philosophers anymore. Comedians are our new philosophers. What the fuck is he talking about? We have philosophers. There are philosophers, Chris. Go to any university. There are people studying philosophy. I talk to philosophers on my podcast Factually. I interview philosophers all the time. And we talk about philosophy, okay? Comedians are just repeating dumbass shit that they heard. They're not thinking about how do we know the world better? How do we separate truthhood from falsehood? Most of the time, they're just like repeating common wisdom in a way that makes people laugh. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But the amount of comedians who are like, yeah, I'm a philosopher. You ever think kids these days aren't as tough because they're not getting bullied anymore? It's like, come on. That's your fucking philosophy, is this old man bullshit that people have been repeating for decades? Like, give me a, like, have a little bit of humility about what it is that you're doing. You're just a guy who knows how to deliver punchlines into a microphone, or a gal. You know, why don't you just accept that that's what you are? Or if you want to be a philosopher, start by reading some fucking Plato, you know? Like, do some, read some fucking Martha Nussbaum. Like, engage with some philosophy if you want to call yourself a philosopher. Either that or just, you know, stick to dick jokes.
Puppies.
I mean, this is a very easy one. Purebred puppies are, it's very bad for the puppies. If you get if you want a particular breed of dog, you are hurting the dogs. Dog breeding is bad for dogs. Dog breeds are not real. They change over time, and almost all dog breeds are getting worse because of inbreeding. The dogs have horrible health problems. And what you should really do is get any kind of what they call mixed breed, which when you hear mixed breed, it just means regular dog as opposed to a fucking genetic freak that some weirdo made in their backyard that is like hurting the dog. You know, just get like, now don't just get any rescue. You want to find one that is, you know, get them as young as you can. One that's been fostered is great. There are a lot of really wonderful rescues that can hook you up with a dog like that. We got our dog from one of these rescues. You know, if you're like, I gotta get a little Labradoodle puppy, you're setting yourself up for a miserable dog who's gonna make you and themselves unhappy. That's a pretty rough one. I'm sorry.
No, I am gonna point out that a Labradoodle is technically a mixed breed, but I understand the point that you're making.
But it's an example of how it's technically a mixed breed because someone made up the breed recently, right? That's right. Why we call it, they combined a Labrador and a Doodle. But that's what all fucking dog breeds are. Like, the Labrador Retriever itself has only existed since, like, the Victorian time, since, like, the 19th century, right?
Right.
It was created by someone else, too. Like, very few dog breeds are older than that. In fact, most of them were created during this vogue for fancy breeding, which was also the same time that eugenics was in. Like, people were just into genetic customization of creatures. And it's bad. Now, there's some breeds that are like much, much older than that, like working breeds. But, you know, those are a little fewer and further between.
All right. The Office.
Your show, The Office?
Yeah.
Or the workplace, yeah. The Office? Your The Office.
Yeah. Ruin it.
Okay. I'm going to go out on a limb here. All right. And don't be mad at me, Brian. All right. But I actually have a real substantive criticism of this period of comedy, of cringe comedy.
Okay.
Is that okay? Is that okay to share?
Sure, of course. So,
and it's really a criticism of Ricky Gervais more than it is of Steve Carell, or because I am an American Office partisan, all right? One of the greatest shows in the history of television, okay? Criminal, by the way. Steve Carell never won an Emmy for that role. Can you believe that?
Never won an Emmy. Criminal.
One of the greatest comedic performances by an actor in American history, by far. Incredible character. But the general trend of cringe comedy that was pioneered by Ricky Gervais in the original Office, I think has aged very poorly, because a common trope that you'll see is you'll see the white person in the scene, right? They will say something that is, quote, accidentally racist. And then the people of color in the scene will be like, what did you say? Or they'll just cock their heads and look quizzically. And then the white person goes, and Ricky Gervais had so many scenes like this, would go, oh, no, that's not what I meant. No, oh, no, it's a little awkward. Isn't that a little awkward that I said that thing that could be racist, but it's not really? You know what I mean? And if you look at what was happening in comedy at the time, this is a time when the entire media industry was still controlled by white people, right? All the writers of these shows were white. All the stars of these shows were white. But they had started to get the message, oh, wait, I shouldn't say, like, racist stuff. But what I've done instead is I've constructed a situation in which I do get to say the racist stuff on television. But the people of color in the scene, I don't get yelled at. They just go, like, huh? Like, it's a little awkward. Uh-oh, it's kind of cute. It's kind of funny. And then the white person has to backpedal and get out of it. And then nothing really bad happens to them because they said something like racist at work, right? In real life, when people say something racist at work, like, it is hurtful. It harms people, you know? It's fucked up. It's not like a cute little awkward moment. But it was this way that, like, white people rewrote racism as being something, oh, it's just a little faux pas, rather than being like, you know, a systemic form of like exclusion from workplace environments. You know what I mean? And that's what I think of when I go back and look at those shows. I'm not saying those scenes aren't funny, but I am saying, oh, we constructed this little fictional idea for ourselves of what racism was. And that's never what it was. It was never about just like, oh, it's slightly awkward. It's something much more serious and fucked up. And I think there's a reason that people don't write comedy that works that way anymore. People don't write that kind of joke about cringe joke about racism that we were writing. And by the way, as I was a sketch comedy writer at the time, I wrote jokes like that too, because that was what I was watching on television. I thought that was funny. But, you know, in the way that people say comedy evolves and our tastes evolve, and we, I think comedy does get better over time. I think that's like an advance that we've made since that time. It's like, you know, not every joke on The Office is like that. But when I look, I'm like, ooh, that's a joke that nobody would write today, because I think we kind of have a different view of those things now. I'm really curious what you think of that as being someone who is obviously on the show.
Well, I think it's an interesting perspective. I think that how it was used on the show was to expose real ideas that, quite frankly, since, and maybe you would have an issue with this too, but really, issues of race in network television comedy hadn't been dealt with at all since, like, All in the Family, which is like 20, 30 years before.
Yeah, true.
It just became like something that nobody would talk about or deal with. And I think that what I was often tremendously proud about the show for doing, despite taking your point about potentially being able to still say a funny joke that really in reality you shouldn't say and don't have much consequences, I feel like people's individual racism it was actually being talked about for the first time. Like, there was actually conversations that came out of it about race. I mean, speaking specifically about Diversity Day or Gay Witch Hunt, which is not about race specifically, but it was actually talking about sexuality, actually talking about race and exposing people's ideas. And despite that it may just be a raised eyebrow, it was an entire group of 16 people responding negatively to that comment, which is that you can't say that. And I would argue that the joke, the laugh, more often than not, came from the response as opposed to the joke. That's what I would say.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That you're enjoying watching Michael Scott get yelled at.
Right.
And one of the reasons one of the reasons I have the preference for The American Office is I think The American Office did a good job of exactly what you're saying, where ultimately the characters who are responding are the characters who are right. They're the ones we're empathizing with. And, you know, Michael Scott really does get like browbeaten, you know, in a way.
Right.
I think Gervais's work generally didn't do that to the same extent. You don't get the sense that like his work, and I'm talking about his other shows as well, didn't, in my view, take those issues as seriously, you know, didn't like actually engage with like what is racism in the workplace or what are these conversations at all. Whereas I think the American Office actually went there and actually took the extra step.
Yeah.
So, it's more of a criticism of that entire period of comedy that I have that not every show dealt with well, but I think, you know, the American Office is one of the better ones.
Right. I know you have to go. Factually podcast.
Yes.
You've done an amazing number of episodes. You're continuing your work. Well, debunking things for people, but talking to, as you say, philosophers and different people, really examining all facets of life. And
yeah,
well, you're able to do more, right, than just the 23 minutes on television.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so on Factually, I interview a different expert from around the world of human knowledge, you know, every episode. We have philosophers on, we have scientists, we have journalists. Sometimes we're doing, you know, current event-based stories. Sometimes we're just doing general knowledge. Like on the episode that's coming out, I'm talking to Steve Brusati, who's a paleontologist, and we talk about why the dinosaurs died out and, you know, the birth of mammals and why mammals eventually took over the world. And it's just a cool general science episode. Then we'll have on, you know, a constitutional scholar to talk about what's going on with, you know, the overturning of Roe versus Wade and what the Constitution really is and how the Supreme Court really works, and try to get a deeper view of how our government works and you know, what are the deep legal issues that go into the changes that we're seeing today. So I like to be able to take, you know, a topic that people are talking about and access it in a deeper way than we normally get on CNN or cable news. And I really follow my own curiosity. You know, I ask these experts, hey, this is what I'm curious about. Like this, I want to figure this out, you know, help me understand. And so it's incredibly rewarding to get to do it. And we've got a really dedicated audience who tunes in, and I hope people check it out. I'm extremely proud of it, and it's a lot of fun. If you love to laugh and you love to learn, come listen to the show. I am funny on the show, by the way. I do my best. And while we're talking about constitutional law, I still do a joke every now and again.
Absolutely. Congratulations on the podcast, on the new show, The G Word. Such an interesting guy. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today, Adam. Thanks so much and good luck. I promise you this, I'll be watching.
I really appreciate it so much, Brian. I've been a fan of yours for years, and so it's so wonderful to hear you say that. And thank you for your wonderfully informed questions. Not a lot of interviewers do their research like Brian Baumgartner does, so I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much. Adam, thank you so much for joining me. I am happy to report that you did not ruin this episode of Off the Beat. You might ruin everything, but you can't ruin me, my friend. Not in the slightest. This was so much fun. Listeners, I'll talk to you next week for yet another episode of Off the Beat. I can't wait. Off the Beat is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our producers are Diego Tapia, Liz Hayes, Hannah Harris, and Emily Carr. Our talent producer is Ryan Papa Zachary, and our intern is Sammy Katz. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by my great friend, Creed Bratton, and the episode was mixed by Seth Olansky.
The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road, but if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge and enjoy 10 smoke-free, spit-free days for just $5.95. Order online and start your new journey today. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.